Okay. Good evening, everyone. Welcome. There should be four different handouts, but you don't need to have one, but it's this way you have something in writing to review. So there's one thing I want to begin with is that I'm not here to really replace your person's rav or the rabbi, and there are different customs for doing different things. And in kashrut, sometimes there are even family customs, something handed down from a person's mother or their parents, or certainly a person should follow what's been handed down to them. And if we say that something's not an absolute requirement or you don't have to do something, that doesn't mean that a person shouldn't follow what they were instructed to do by their mother or their rav. These are just general guidelines that are given out, and hopefully they'll be useful to everyone. The truth is that kashrus is a very wide subject. And as I was preparing for this class, I realized that we could really do a lot more than three sessions. And so we'll try to do what we can do. For this class, the first one is kind of interesting. I decided that let's assume that everything that we bought from the store was kosher, and it was brought home to our house. Now, then what can go wrong with it afterwards in the kitchen? And so there were a few subjects that I wanted to cover, and also based on phone calls that I've actually gotten in the Kashrus Commission, we take phone calls all the time, of mistakes that people have made or not known about dealing with several of the issues which I hope to cover today. I like to give some background to Kashrus, but we all know that Kashrus is a chok, which means ultimately Hashem in His wisdom gave it to us, and we will never fully fathom the reasons why Hashem gave us all the laws of Kashrus. One thing we know, and that is the very first mitzvah of the Adam and Chava in Gan Eden was to be careful with what they eat. We didn't do so well. but we believe, right, that by keeping kosher, we make our house special, and food is fuel. It's what keeps us alive. It's what keeps us going. And by being careful what we eat and how we process the food that we use, we help sanctify ourselves and we help sanctify our households. Okay. I first wanted to start with something that has nothing to do with kashrus. That's this sheet called Mixing Fish and Meat. It doesn't have anything to do with kashrus. If kashrus means what you can eat and what you can't eat, then it does have to do with kashrus. But it doesn't directly relate to kashrus, meaning the Torah laws about what you can eat and what you can't eat. The Torah commands us to guard our health. And by the way, if a person is convinced that there are certain foods that are not healthy, if the doctor says, you know, don't eat too much salt and don't eat too much sugar and don't eat, then it's a mitzvah to find good ways to serve healthy food, certainly to keep yourself and your family healthy. We have a tradition passed down to us for centuries from the rabbis that certain foods are not healthy. There's a certain danger involved. And we have great respect for our traditions. We know, for example, during the Black Plague in the Middle Ages that the non-Jewish world were dropping like flies and the Jewish communities were not as heavily affected. And that was a mystery to everyone. And their answer was that we were poisoning the wells. And then they went and they massacred a lot of the Jews. But the real reason was that the Jews followed kashrus laws and cleanliness laws, washing their hands and being careful with the food and other things, and those laws protected them, and therefore they didn't get the diseases and they didn't die to the same extent that the Gentiles did. The first thing on the list is something that we're actually required to do, meaning that it's actually brought down throughout all the ages as being a Jewish custom. And something that's been kept by the Jewish people for many, many centuries, a custom that is universal becomes binding. And that custom is not to mix meat and fish together. Now, we don't know exactly what's wrong. It might be, we believe that there's a certain kind of meat that if it's prepared with a certain kind of fish, a person will get sick from. And I've spoken to chefs, and they say, well, true, they have different points of cooking. So if you were to cook the two together, there are definitely certain things that would not be advisable. But we really don't know exactly today exactly which fish and which meat are not healthy or not good. But we have that clear tradition passed down to us that Jews did not mix fish and meat in the same plate. We don't eat them together. But if fish and meat are cooked together, they would not make the dishes non-kosher. And even though typically we try to avoid anything non-kosher, our understanding is if there's a small amount of fish or meat in something, it could be nullified. So, for example, Worcestershire sauce, which is always made with anchovies, don't tell anyone, it's a fish. And if you like Worcestershire sauce on your meat, you're allowed to use some Worcestershire sauce. Can't pronounce that very well. You're allowed to use some Worcestershire sauce if the fish in the Worcestershire sauce is buccal, if it's nullified, if it's less than a 1/60. And the way you can tell is that there are two different Worcestershire sauces. One of them says plain OU, and one next to the OU says OU fish. So the one that says OU fish has more than a 1/60 of fish, and it cannot be used on meat directly because of our tradition that we don't mix meat and fish. The Worcestershire sauce that has less than a 1/60 of fish, even though if you look in the ingredients, I always get this call, you know, I found it, there was OU blue, this one that says fish in the ingredients, you're still allowed to use that. If it doesn't say OU fish, then you're allowed to use that Worcestershire sauce on the fish, according to most authorities. There's a new orange juice out there that's heart healthy, that has fish oil in it. And that also has the OU fish designation, which means that you wouldn't want to drink that orange juice with your meat. Because again, that would be mixing fish and meat. That would not be acceptable. Do you need a special fish pot and a special separate to cook fish and meat? So that's the second question. It technically is not required. Many people have that custom in their families, but not a bad idea. They have a fish pot. And certainly if your mother had a fish pot, you should have a fish pot. But you're not required al pi halacha. You can't say to somebody that they can't just clean out a meat pot well and then cook fish on it. The same thing would apply to a grill, that if you grill meat, you can use the same grill for fish. But obviously you have to be careful that it's fully cleaned. And grills aren't that easy to clean. You'd have to, you know, there's a lot of grease and other things. But if, in theory, if it's cleaned well and there's no grease left, then you could use the same grill for fish and for meat. It would be considered cooked on meat equipment. In other words, if you cooked fish on a meat grill that happened to be clean, so we would consider it, just like we have DE, which means things cooked on dairy equipment, we have things that are cooked on meat equipment, and so therefore we wouldn't be conflating by eating it, but we wouldn't want to serve it on a dairy dish. For Sephardim, it could be a little bit different. But for Ashkenaz, we wouldn't serve anything cooked in meat equipment. We wouldn't serve it directly on a dairy dish. Okay. You wouldn't cook...
Mm-hmm. You have to clean the grill and burn it first mm-hmm. before you put the fish on it. Let's say you clean the grill.
Mm-hmm.
And then you turned it on and burned it for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever.
Right.
And then...
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a basic rule that something that's cooked in meat equipment on a meat pot, let's say we cook vegetables in a meat pot,
Correct. We
wouldn't then serve it on dairy dishes.
Okay.
That's the Ashkenazi custom, not to serve something. So if fish is cooked in a meat pot, then we also wouldn't serve it directly on dairy dishes. So now, if you koshered it in between or made it parv, then you could serve it on dairy dishes. Maybe there's a separate rack for it or something that fits on, you know, then it really...
Aluminum foil or something.
or something like that. So then it really wouldn't be like something cooked on meat equipment. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. For example.
No, cold fish.
In other words, if the fish was cooked.
You barbecue your fish on Friday and serve a Saturday lunch, and you have a dairy meal.
Could you serve it on dairy plates? I'm not sure. Could be some people would. Could be. I can look into that for you if I remember. Okay. Yes.
What about the fish, like the grill fish holder that you put the fish in, and then you put it on the grill? So it's still touching the grill, even though it's in this fish holder.
If the grill is always clean before you put that on.
Meat equipment.
Well, if it's designed to hold the fish, and it never holds the meat itself, then it probably would be, it could be, in theory, it's just fish, yeah. Okay. Can you cook fish and meat in separate pots together? That would be fine. If they're both covered, that would be fine. If one of them is uncovered, that would be a problem. We do allow a buffet to have meat and fish in it, and so therefore you could go to a function and there could be the lox on one end and chop liver at the other. And so as long as you're not required to eat them together, and in theory you could have a clean plate and a clean fork in between, we assume that a person would know that if I'm at a kiddush and I put fish on my plate, I should, there's an ancient custom to drink a l'chaim in between, clean out your mouth. Of course, that's why we all do that, right? And then you can have the meat and fish afterwards. But they're allowed to be served within the same setting, as long as typically we wouldn't have, if a person only has one dish, you wouldn't serve meat and fish. But if the person has a buffet setting where there's disposables and they know that they can get one and wash out their mouth, or maybe they won't eat the other, the only thing we try to do is we try to ask the caterers or whoever's doing it, if it's not clear what it is, to label it fish or label it meat. Because sometimes there's a dish that you have no idea what it is. So if you go to the buffet and you think, you know, you just ate meat and then they're serving fish. But a person does need to be careful, especially when they pass things around. Sometimes they're passing, you know, a person just had a piece of fish and they're passing a meat, you know, dish around, that they've cleaned out their mouth in between and they've used a separate fork. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
It, either way, it's fine, even though it seems traditionally the fish comes first, but I don't know where that comes from. Now, the second part, if you've never heard of it, you can take your pen and cross it out. Hear about the peeled onions, garlic, and eggs. The reason why I put that here, we've got a lot of questions about it. There is something mentioned, I'll take your question in a minute. It is mentioned in the Talmud, this second rule here about leaving peeled onions, garlic, and eggs overnight. But it's not brought down in the Jewish code of law, which is interesting, because the Jewish code of law brings down everything that's binding upon us. And the Jewish code of law does bring the first part about meat and fish. So many people do have a custom handed down from the times of the Talmud over 2,000 years not to leave peeled onion, garlic, or eggs overnight. And if you have that custom in your family, then these rules would apply. If you've never had this custom, you're not obligated to start having it now. But I wanted you to be aware of it, because you sometimes run into someone who sees you, you know, that you left an onion in the fridge, or they did this and they did that, and a person should just know where it comes from. So, if it's not your family custom and you've never heard about it and you don't want to worry about it, you're not obligated to worry about it at all. But it is mentioned in the Talmud as being something that could be potentially harmful, and there are many, many people that have a custom to try to avoid it. And therefore, what they do is they don't fully peel onions, garlic, or eggs and leave them overnight. Either what they do is they leave a piece of the shell. If you've never heard of it, it's very funny when you come across it. What they do is they put it into a salad, or they use it right away. They just don't let it sit overnight. And that's the second part of this, and this is what's brought down here. This was from the Starkey website, by the way, that we took it. But I just, again, if you have a kosher kitchen and someone says something to you, you sometimes wonder, well, I grew up in a kosher home, I never heard of this. There is such a custom. There is such a custom, and it certainly, if you have it, or if and there is a reason for the custom, but if you don't have it, you're not obligated to take it upon yourself. Yes. Well, we didn't discuss that really. Which one? You talking about the third? This cooked fish should eat in separate covered pots. It says it's permissible. So you want to know if only one is covered? This question is if they're both uncovered. You're asking if one is covered and one is not, would that be all right? I have to think about it. I'll tell you why. There is when you cook something uncovered, it creates a steam. And I suppose it depends how well. It also depends how liquidy the other item would be. So I would say if it's something you do all the time, then you should ask a Shiloh or look into it to find out if it's well, certainly if they're both covered, it's permissible. The filter fish I don't think would be a problem. The one of the things we'll, if we have time, that we'll see certain things don't necessarily make a steam, and therefore it wouldn't be an issue in an oven. Okay, moving along. So this is the first non-kashrus thing that we talked about. And again, if you don't have the custom, just put an X to the bottom, but it shouldn't sound strange to you if you come across it. And especially, I would say the old Europeans, you know, it's very common amongst, you know, that you'll hear of these customs. The Hasidic groups, many of them follow them, all the Hungarians, you'll hear about that. Yeah. Yeah, that apparently is okay. That seems even according to that custom, as long as some of it has this, they just don't like to fully leave it unpeeled, apparently. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's widespread in some circles. Yeah. Oh, so basically, if you have the custom not to use these peeled onions or peeled garlic, so then how can you go to the store and buy it? So Rabbi Feinstein says you don't have to worry about it. So even if someone has that custom, they're allowed to go and buy the ones with the preservatives that are in the vegetable store. Okay, moving along. It's hard to know. It's very hard to know what the exactly in which way would it be prepared that would be harmful, and that's a little bit of a challenge. Okay. All right. We'll do one other thing that's not directly kashrus but is a little bit related, and that's called the Tfilas Kalim guidelines. Tfilas Kalim. Now, if something did not go to the mikvah yet, if a vessel wasn't yet toiveled, that means it wasn't yet taken to the mikvah, and you cook with it by mistake, the food is still kosher. The kashrus is not affected at all by the vessel, whether it was taken to the mikvah or not. In other words, if it didn't go to the only thing is, if we're given, let's say, a plate or a fork or a knife that was never used, taken to the mikvah, before we use it to eat, we're obligated to make sure it's toiveled first. So if somebody were to serve us on a plate and that plate had never been toiveled, so technically, even though the food is still kosher, we're not allowed to use that fork and knife on plate or glass that's there because we have a mitzvah to toivel it first. We're not supposed to use brand new equipment that's been purchased from a non-Jew until it's been toiveled. That's how we have a mitzvah, and by using it without making sure it went to the mitzvah, we would be nullifying that mitzvah. Therefore, that's why sometimes if somebody doesn't take things to a mitzvah necessarily, somebody wouldn't have a cup of water. They would use a paper cup at the house of somebody that is Jewish but doesn't take things to a mitzvah because the glass cup would really need to go to a mitzvah first. Now, it's kosher, but by using that cup, I'm really, at the time I take the cup in my hand, I'm really obligated to, I have a mitzvah to go sanctify this cup and make it holy and baptize it and dunk it in the mikvah. But therefore, it would be best if somebody knows that that person doesn't toivel their kalim to use disposables or things that are not a problem. If they have a well, if they have snow, swimming pools probably not. If they had enough snow, depending on what neighborhood it's in, you know, up north, there are certain times you can toivel things in snow. You need a certain amount. Now, so we'll get to that. Okay. So, we have a mitzvah. Now, what you could do, if it's put into something that was not toivled, and they have something that is toivled, you could simply move it to the toivled item. That would be no problem. In other words, somebody cooked with something that wasn't there, they forgot, they didn't realize, they thought it was, and they found out it wasn't, the food is still kosher. But you would simply remove it then to the dish that was already toivled. Now, if something is toivled, and it wasn't fully, the water didn't touch the entire item that was toivled. For example, if there was a price tag on the dish, or on the piece of silverware, or on the pot, and then they toivled it, so then it wasn't toivled, because toivled means fully immersing the thing entirely into the body of water. And since it had a price tag, or it had something on, so in the halacha it's called a chatzitza, so then that's not toivled. So occasionally that happens, that you cook and you just didn't notice a tag or something that was there. So even if it went to the mikvah, it would have to remove the tag and then re-toivel it afterwards. Because again, toiveling means that something is fully submerged into water, totally. And so if it has something that's an interposition between the water and the pot, then it's not fully submerged. Now, if the tag is designed to stay there all the time, like sometimes people want to show off that they bought designer pots, then you don't have to take off the tag. Or it's very common on Kiddush cups. You want to show it's real silver. It has, like, underneath. You don't have to take that. If it's meant to be there permanently, even though it could come off, you don't have to take it off. It's only something that you would normally be embarrassed at some point to leave it on with a price tag or to leave it on with something sticky. Then you have to remove it. Okay. Now, the first rule, there's just two or three little things I want to mention. What I liked about this list is there are a number of things that people toivel that you really don't have to. Basically, if it doesn't come into direct food contact, then you don't have to toivel it. If there's certain materials that never need toiveling, things like plastic. Things that are disposable, they do not need to be toiveled if they're disposable. Now, sometimes there's something disposable that you use, you don't plan on disposing it right away. So for you, it's not a disposable. So if you buy like an aluminum disposable pan, but you intend on using it for several uses, according to most people, you'd have to toivel it. What if you line it? So I think that's a question for a rabbi. I think it would be all right, but you can ask your... Yeah, I think it's not a problem if you line something with foil. It's not in other words, if you're not let's say something that wasn't toiveled and you line it with foil, I think it would be all right, but you can check with your rabbi if you want on that. Yes.
Can you use more than once if you've washed it out and you're using it, or are you doing like putting a chicken in it and you're
doing
a whole bit of stuff left over and now you're eating the chicken?
Okay.
Instead of using it more than once.
I don't have a real good definition. But I would say that some people think that you can use anything just the first time. That's not so. In other words, if you buy a regular pot, it's not like the first time it's home free. It's only that if you buy something that's really disposable and you can use it because it's disposable, then if it happens to be, you then change your mind and decide you want to use it, then you would need to toivel it. But there is no such thing as the first time you don't have to worry about it. It's only if something is really initially disposable. So since it's disposable, that's not something that's not called a utensil. A utensil is something that you plan on keeping. Okay. Yes.
So if your original intention on pan of chicken was that you were going to throw it away. The intention was it's disposable.
Right.
So then isn't it really disposable and I can reuse that chicken?
Well, the first time you used it, it was not considered a utensil, and therefore it didn't need to go to the mikvah.
Right.
But then, you decided, hey, I kind of like this. I'm going to use it a few more times. So that is,
I bought this because I don't want to scrub on Shabbos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
And I make my chicken in it, and there's leftover more than I thought. My guest born is hungry. Put it in the refrigerator. Sunday afternoon, I take it out to reheat it.
Oh, that's no problem. I thought you meant to take the chicken out and put something else in. The same item, I don't think is any problem with me. That's no problem. I don't know. If you wanted to, sometimes it becomes hard to define what's reusing something. Yeah. So the first one is to use it more than once. Oh, I see. No. It doesn't have to go at all. That's correct. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah, I'm not... I have to think where I got this list from. The one issue that people have, and that's a challenge, is that sometimes you buy a utensil that's electric, and you really don't want to get it wet. So if you don't mind getting it wet, then certainly ideally you're supposed to toivel a utensil. The problem is, what do you do if you can't get it wet? So you have to speak to your rav. There are a few different approaches what to do if you don't get it. Sometimes what you can do is you can toivel it just the part that touches the food. In other words, if let's say you have an urn or something and you keep the electrical part not fully dipped in. Sometimes you can disassemble it and then reassemble it. And so it turns out that it's then being made by a Jew. Sometimes you can sell it or sell part of it to a non-Jew and share the ownership with them. There are different approaches that are used. Things that are really big and meant to be stay in one place, like sometimes like a big water urn that stays plugged in all the time, there's a view that that's like connected to the house. And so something that's connected to the ground doesn't need to be totaled. So it's something that's meant to stay in like a big, heavy kind of electrical thing. And these are all solutions that rabbis will discuss. In most cases, people do toivel things that the manufacturer says do not immerse.
Yeah.
And in most, even though I tell people that I don't take any responsibility, most people do toivel them and they have no problem with them as long as they wait for them to fully dry out. If you do toivel something that's electric, you don't have to wait for the water to go to the inside of the mechanism. It has to go to the inside where the food touches, but you don't have to wait for the bubbles in the water to hit, like the inside of the electrical part. But again, speak to your rav, and if you have a challenge with it. But there is no question that ideally, if it hits direct food surfaces, it should be the halacha reads that it requires tefillah. And then, if for some reason that's difficult, then you look to the posuk to see what the solution would be. Okay. Those are the basic. And then again, there are some things here that are, if you look at them, the reason why you're not required to do a tefillah, for example, the outside of a crock pot, because the food doesn't touch the outside of the crock pot. A warming tray. Typically, a warming tray, people don't put the, it's not designed to put the food directly on. Most of the time, you either have foil on or there's a pot on it. Things like that, because they're not in direct contact with food, therefore they don't need to be totaled. Yeah. The things that are made from the materials mentioned in the Chumash, we make a bracha. So things that are either combinations, for example, glass has some of the materials that are used in metal. And metal is mentioned in the Torah. It has some of the same minerals. But since it's not actually mentioned in the Torah, therefore we don't make the bracha. And you can make one bracha for everything, by the way. And if you're not sure, we don't make a bracha, but you can still go ahead and tell it. Yeah. Correct. That's right. Okay. Let's move along, please. Okay. Now we're going to talk about blood. A lot of fun here. Okay. One of the things, if we have a little time, we'll talk about milk and meat also. One thing is striking, and that is, in our society, we see a lot of vegetarians because they don't like the way society handles the animals. Sometimes they're a little bit cruel to animals, or the methods that are used on some of the animals they feel are cruel. And the Torah doesn't say we're not allowed to use animals. In fact, Hashem created animals to serve man. But the Torah wants us to use animals. It wants us to do it with a sense of compassion and not cause any unnecessary pain to the animals. And, for example, when the Torah says not to mix milk and meat, it says don't cook a child in its mother's milk, which is saying don't take, don't take meat and cook it in milk, because that would be cruel. That's unusually cruel. Or, eating something in its blood is unusually cruel. And so you could understand that the Torah is saying that, yes, you can use the animal world, but we still, at the same time, we have to be careful not to be cruel and not to abuse the animal world. And perhaps that's part of the lesson of removing the blood. Fish blood is not a problem. In case you were interested. It's not considered blood, by the way. Now, the first thing we'll talk about is the egg blood, the modern-day blood spot. Now, egg blood, a blood spot in an egg, is not really blood. It's not, well, the problem with it is not the blood problem. The problem in most cases with eggs, the reason why we're so careful to check eggs, is that when you used to find eggs in blood in eggs, it was a sign that the egg was starting to fertilize. And if the egg was starting to fertilize, it was becoming a chick. And the only way we're allowed to eat a chick is if it's shefted in a kosher way. So if you saw a blood spot in an egg, that meant that not only that spot was not kosher, but the entire egg was not kosher because it was turning into a chick. And if the entire egg is not kosher, that creates big problems. Because if you were cooking eggs in a pot, that whole egg was a chick, so that whole egg was a non-kosher chick that was cooking in your egg pot. So our grandmothers didn't want to have to kosher their pots and have problems. So there was an ancient custom that they always cooked at least 3 eggs at a time. So in case one of them turned out to be a chick, this way you'd have 2 that were not chicks. And we have a rule in as far as if the majority in this particular case would be kosher, it wouldn't make the pot non-kosher. And so there is a custom that some people have that always make at least 3 eggs. And again, if that's been passed down to you, you certainly should keep that custom. And if you're using organic eggs, you'd be required to do that unless you wanted to re-kosher your pot potentially. Most of our eggs, if they're not organic, are eggs that will never fertilize. They just will never, you could put them under a hot lamp, they'll never turn into a chick. The way they're hatched, they're done artificially, and since they'll never turn into a chick, you really will never have a problem with your pot becoming non-kosher, even if there's a blood spot in one of the eggs that you make. So really it's not required to cook 3 eggs. Again, if you have that custom, please, please do what your mother taught you. It's actually brought down over here on number 4 on the modern day bus. You're not required to cook 3 eggs at a time. if it's not organic. Because of this, because today we don't have chicks in the eggs, that also there's two other leniencies. First of all, when you make hard-boiled eggs, you don't check them at all because they're hard-boiled. And the reason is because besides the fact that the vast majority are chicks, but today we don't worry about that. Now, because of that, if we forgot to check the eggs, it would still be acceptable because today the blood spot is not what it used to be. Nothing in life is what it used to be. But because, again, it doesn't turn into a chick, when it turned into a chick, it was a real requirement. And then not only was the blood spot a problem, but the whole egg was a problem. But today, it's only the blood spot that's a problem. And in theory, if you really want to save the egg, you could. What's happened is that eggs, there was a time when people couldn't afford eggs. And you had to share an egg. You know, they talked about in between the wars where one whole family would have one egg for 5 people or 10 people. Today it's not like that, and so typically if we find a blood spot, we just throw out the whole egg. But if for some reason that's a problem, or let's say it's in a mix, so you can just take out the blood spot and use the rest. And that's quoted here as well. The one thing about the custom that is mentioned is that you should ideally check for it in a container that you can see all four sides. That's where the people use the glass to check the egg in over here, and that's on number 2 and number 3, and that's the basic rule here. But again, there's a lot of confusion about that because eggs in previous times were a much greater problem than they are today. All right, moving along. Liver, kashering liver. That's on the next one. The guidelines for kashering liver. So there are a few things that. First of all, many people are under the impression if you go to a kosher store or a kosher butcher and an item has a kosher mark on it, that means it's good to go. It's not true. If you bought liver, that liver is not kashered yet. Now, when we say that liver is not kashered yet, we don't mean it's not kosher. It came from a kosher animal. The animal was shechted. But typically, when we buy meat from the kosher butcher, now, things have changed. Years ago, when you bought meat, you had to soak it and salt it yourself. But typically today, almost all meat that's bought from, and certainly in Atlanta, is already kashered. It's already soaked and salted, no problem. Liver, soaking and salting won't help because liver, the blood is congealed inside the liver, and soaking and salting will not remove enough of the blood to make that liver kosher. So the only way to have kosher liver is to broil it. Now, they actually make a pre-boiled liver. You can find that in the stores. They make it where it's already pre-boiled. Then you can just buy it and take it home. Sometimes, and this was a problem with science, people buy a turkey, and inside the turkey, inside, they have a liver. And if you go and you cook the turkey, and then you discover the liver there, you have a real potential problem because that liver was never kashered. And there's blood inside the turkey. And that's a huge, huge problem that comes up relatively often, always on Erev Shabbos when they find the liver is still inside there. But before you can eat liver, it needs to be kosher, typically, and that needs to be broiled. And there's some special rules from the broiling here. Yes? In the bag that's inside the bird, yes.
You don't have to go inside of a turkey or a chicken. Be sure there's no liver tissue in here.
Right. No, we don't have to. Occasionally they goof, though, by the way, but you don't have to look for it. But as long as we just look for the bag. If the bag is there, certain brands always have the bag in, and certain brands never put the bag in. But certainly you want to remove. The problem is when it's frozen, sometimes it's hard to stick your hand in there and make sure the bag is removed. Now, in order to kosher the liver, there's two problems that come up, and a lot of people aren't aware of them. One is that if the liver was sitting in blood for 24 hours, the blood can never be removed. So if there's juice, like sitting in the liver, and it sits overnight like that, then the boiling won't even help. And so that's why it's mentioned over here that it says here in 1, like when you get the liver, if it's like sitting in his blood, and like in the juice, one of the things that we're going to see when you broil the liver in the oven, the most important thing is that the blood can flow away from the liver. In other words, when you broil it, whatever you boil it on has to be that the blood can drip away. Because if it's going to sit in the blood, that's going to create a problem. So even if you have kosher liver, if that liver is sitting with lots of juice, and it's sitting in that juice for 24 hours, and that juice is blood juice, then you have a problem. So those are two things that he warns about over here, which are just, again, people just may not be aware that that could be a problem in kashering liver. The second problem that is not well known is the following. When we broil liver and take the blood out, many times the broiling makes the liver kind of charred and nasty tasting or whatever. And so in order to get rid of that nasty taste of the, you know, if you overburnt it, because you want to burn it enough that it's not pink on the inside, because then you can get rid of all the blood. So one of the secrets all the chefs will tell you is that after they've burnt it, they then saute it or boil it. Right? And you say, well, what's the problem? So there is a problem. And that is that if the liver has more than 72 hours, more than 3 days have gone by since the liver was taken from the animal, then you're not allowed to boil it or broil it after, not allowed to boil it or saute it after it's been kashered. So in theory, if more than 3 days have gone by since this liver was slaughtered, you can't take it after you broil it and then boil it or saute it. Now, the only thing is that usually most of the rabbis hold that if it's been frozen within 3 days, you still get the 3 days. So typically when we buy something frozen, it would still be within the 3 days. But if it is your custom to do something to the liver after you broiled it, you may want to check with the, you know, wherever you're buying the liver from, if the 3 days have gone by, and you may want to check with your rabbi if it's okay, because the problem may be that the blood doesn't fully come out once it's sat 3 days in the blood. It's a tricky business getting the blood out. That's really what it boils down to. And in the liver, it just holds on to it. And so within 3 days, if it's broiled, then everything is great. If it's after 3 days, and then it's broiled, it's still kosher, but then you run into questions if you want to then boil it or then saute it. And, you know, if that's how you always like to make it, it's worth looking into it once and making sure the brand that you buy and the method that you use is acceptable. That's what's mentioned here, as well as the utensils that you use to broil the liver on should be separate. You should have a separate special fork just for liver, a separate grill, a separate, everything should be separate, and when you wash it, you also keep it separate. Because these utensils that we use for the liver, they have blood on them. They are used with, and so you need to be careful with it. And then, again, you can read this. This is just a basic description of how the liver goes. Again, I just wanted to mention, because some people aren't aware of it, and it's not something you do every day. Or not a lot of us, yeah. Yes, yeah, that one is pre-kashered, by the way. Okay, now the last subject I wanted to talk to, again, was you're in your kosher kitchen, and what other problems could you have? So I wanted to talk about milk and meat. Milk and meat are a problem because most of us don't have two ovens, and most of us don't have two sinks. So in those areas, and most of us don't have two dishwashers, so we sometimes run into challenges keeping the milk and meat separate. So ideally, let's start off with the sink. That's a little bit easier. The ideal thing is to have just two separate dishpans, a milk dishpan and a meat dishpan. Sometimes if you have two separate sinks, that's great. If you only have two sinks right next to each other, you could have a lot of questions because it splatters very easily from one to the other. The best sink, in other words, if you do have the two sinks next to each other, what most people recommend is either having a cover that you cover one side when you're using the other, or you have some kind of, they make this in the kitchen stores, like a little device that like raises the edge of the sink so it doesn't sit like a, it's like a thing that sits in on the inside of it, like a splash guard kind of sink. And that's what we would recommend if you have the sinks that are side by side. Let's see. But it is an area to be careful with. If something was put into the wrong bucket or the wrong sink, and it didn't come into direct contact with heat, then it can just typically be rinsed off. What we're going to see is that in order for something to become non-kosher, it would have had to have had contact with heat. Heat is what would cause something to get absorbed into something else. The other way would be if it sat 24 hours. So, for example, somebody took a neat cup and they poured milk in, and so there's no heat involved, so you could just rinse it out. But if that neat cup had milk in it for 24 hours, then it would be potentially a problem, because when a liquid sits in something for 24 hours, so things get absorbed into things either after 24 hours in a liquid form or if there's a medium of heat. But if it's not hot, if it's only warm, if it's if it's something that was transferred, from the within the pot and then put on the serving platter and then brought to the table, so it's not a direct heat. So many times it is not a direct problem as far as the sink goes. The biggest questions come about with one oven. What do you do with one oven if you want to cook milchik and leishik, or if you want to cook parak? Typically, most people only have enough room for one oven. So it is easy, in other words, if you have the room to have, two ovens, or to have, a lot of people have a toaster oven for milchik and they use a big oven for fleishik, or the other way around. Certainly that's a no hassle way to do it, but sometimes it just doesn't work. So what do you do if you only have one oven? So what most people do, again, a person who speaks to their rabbi, or they're different, depends on your kitchen habits, is that you pick the main use of the oven. In other words, if most of your cooking is fleishik, then you make the oven fleishik. If most of your cooking is milchik, then you make the oven milchik. Whenever you cook, and so let's say most of your cooking is fleishik. That's what most people do, their main cooking. So they'll call this a fleishik oven. And that means that you cook uncovered fleishik in this oven. What do you do if you want to cook milchik? So whenever you cook milchik, or you want to cook milchik in this meat oven, you always make sure they're covered. And then you're allowed to take the milchik pan, put it on the rack, assuming the rack doesn't have any spillage left over from meat, and cook it covered in the meat oven. That would be fine, and that would be no problem. And on the occasions that shulis is coming up and you need to cook milchik, you can kosher the oven and make it fully parv or milchik and go back and forth. That would be acceptable. But that's the most common way to have an oven, is to make it one main use. It's milchik, it's fleishik, and that, whatever the main use is, you cook in there uncovered. And whenever you cook the opposite thing, you always keep it covered. Because if you were to cook meat uncovered and then cook milk uncovered in the same oven, that would not be kosher. That would cause a problem. Now, one thing to mention is that we have a rule that bread has to be parv. The halacha, you're not allowed to have milk bread or fleishik bread. Everybody knows, when you want to buy an old bread that's kosher, whatever the ones you like always have a D on it, which means it has dairy in it, you can't buy it, and because we have a rabbinic law that we don't use milk bread. But we also don't use fleishik bread. Because bread has to be usable with either kind, milk or fleishik. I remember someone called me up about Arnold's, and they said, I can't find any of this parv. I want to buy it. Is it kosher? I said, well, it's made in a kosher factory. That's why it has a K on there. But the rabbis say you're not supposed to have milchik bread. And they said, well, why not? And they said, well, bread is something that's a staple. People sometimes use it for meat. And even if I don't plan on using it for meat, the rabbi said you shouldn't have something like that lying around the house. There are some views that if you eat it like a one-time amount, eat the whole thing in one shot, it could be as permissible, and there are different scenarios a person can look at. But typically, we just don't buy milchik bread. This person said, oh, I don't care what the rabbis say. As long as it's kosher, I said, look, I told you what the rule is, do what you want. So the person called me back 6 months later. She said, Rabbi, she said, I went and I bought the milchik bread, I just wanted to, I keep kosher, but I didn't want to follow with it. And my son came home from school one night, and he was starving, and he put cold cuts and salami sandwich on the bread. I'm not messing with the rabbis anymore. So we don't have milk as a fleshy bread. So then how can you bake your bread, your challah, in a fleshy oven? So the good news is that challah is a very, typically, it's not a liquidy batter. It's not, challah is a dry thing. And so therefore, in order to become fleshik, when you put your challah in the fleshik oven, it could only become fleshik in two ways. One, if there's drops of meat in the oven. So if you bake challah, you have to make sure there's no drops of meat, you know, nothing splattered that's in the oven. The other problem would be not to splatter in the oven, but what if absorbed into the walls of the oven, there's gravy, juice. That would not be a problem if you're cooking something dry, like challah, because the challah doesn't have enough steam to go up into the walls of the oven and bring the meat juice back into your challah. So as long as you have a part of baked pan, and as long as there's no gravy juice or anything liquidy like that in your oven, so you can bake fully part of challah in your meat oven and serve it with milk inflation, so whatever you want. And in theory, like cookie dough or things that are dry, would also be able to put part of in your meat oven as well, or in your dairy oven. Because again, as long as there's no physical remnant of the meat or dairy in the oven, and as long as the item is a dry dough, like a challah dough, you know, that doesn't have like a lid sitting in a liquid, it wouldn't become milchik or fleshik at that moment. And that's, okay.
What did you mean when you said that
you're
going to splatter? Are you talking about on the rack?
No, in the oven, anything like, some people just wipe it out before they start.
Okay.
They preheat it a little bit and they wipe it out, or they just make sure that if they just made supper, let's say chicken, and they splatter, before they make the challah, they would, you know, just wipe out any grease or anything like that.
Do you have to double wrap the dairy? Is it going
to be done? No, a single wrap is sufficient. Yeah.
I've always
not understood this, and I still don't understand. Okay.
Does it still become meat if it's cooked in a meat oven?
Okay, that's a good question. So,
I don't know about the other part.
Right.
You know, I'll put
right.
Know,
if,
totally
right. There is. Right. So, if the oven racks have grease on them, then in theory you'd want to put foil down in between the oven rack and the pyro pan.
But the energy from the
But in order for the energy from the steam of the oven to make this pan meat, you'd have to have a liquid in the batter. And since you would, yeah. So if you just have a challah dough, so there's not enough liquid in the challah dough to create a steam that would come back and make the pan fleshy.
That's the same as in a meat oven. You have a dairy cover.
Right.
The pan doesn't get...
Because it's covered, so the steam doesn't leave... Oh, so again, so if the rack has grease on it, so then you want to put foil on the meat. But if your racks are relatively clean, if you preheat your oven, then there are some people that assume that racks are clean enough because of the grease won't stay on it; it'll drip down, and typically things bake in it and stuff. Yeah. So put one layer of foil underneath it if you're concerned, and then put the meat pan or the challah board on top of it. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, but in theory it might be able to do it, but I don't think in practice I think we avoid cooking something dairy in meat equipment. You know, the same way we avoid putting it on a meat dish, we would avoid, but in theory it probably wouldn't become trace. Yeah. Yeah.
Draw the line between a dough that's dry and a dough that's liquid.
Uh-huh. So
how do I know?
So there, there sometimes there's a nuance of a posik, or like a rabbi, some will, you know, different people will have, you know, touch it with your finger. If your finger becomes wet, then it's liquidy. If it stays dry, or there might be different rules of thumb to decide. But sourdough is always assumed to be.
But I personally, a lot of baking. So I, like, where do I draw the line between banana bread and cup?
Right. Right. So you may actually have to show the banana dough to a rabbi and see how what he thinks, or try to get a good guideline from, you know, the from if you do a lot of baking and that's something you want to do, to figure out what the. We have similar questions when it comes to Shabbos reheating, whether something's considered liquidy. So what's considered liquidy, right? Some things are. So there's certain. It's good to just get a good guideline. You know the dishes that you like to cook, and then just. You know, either show them to a rabbi or talk to a rabbi who's familiar with them to give you a, you know, a rule of thumb. I do plan on doing, probably not the next session, but on the final session, I hope to do a review on how to check fruits and vegetables. And hopefully we'll find some bugs. But you know what they say, you always go and you try to show everybody how to check, and that batch does not have a single bug on it. So maybe on the last session, if somebody has some very buggy lettuce they want to bring in, what? we'll see. We'll get to that, and I hope to get cover a lot, of, including some, you know, even some very practical things as well. But I wanted to start off with some of the basic halachas or things that people are not real familiar. I'll take questions privately. I just don't want to hold up Rabbi Kransky's class.